Okay, I think we will begin. Welcome to this 21st century auditorium. It's the first time I've been in here. As I was coming in, one of a friend here, I think Selena, was saying, when I was at the LSE, it wasn't like this. I remember Lord Meghnad Desai, used to teach economics here for many years, said, we had the best educated slum in London. And, well, it's certainly no longer a slum. But I still hope to think it's still the best educated place in London. But anyway, very nice to welcome you here this evening. This is organised by LSE Ideas, which is the London School of Economics research centre, but also a foreign policy think tank within the LSE and within the global think tank system, if it can be called that. I'm bound to say that we compete against other think tanks, and ten days ago, we were recently voted number one in the world of all university-affiliated think tanks. Thank you very much, thank you. Well, we're very pleased, anyway. I've told everybody this, so they know it already, so it doesn't matter. But anyway, it was very nice to be rated that way, and as somebody said to me in an email, there's only one way you can go now. And I thought, well, no pressure then, as they would say. I'm one of the directors of LSE Ideas and have been so since 2008, but I've been joined more recently over the last year and a half by a co-director, another director, Professor Christopher Coker, Emeritus Professor of International Relations here at the LSE. And I should also say both Christopher and I are privileged to lead such a great team, many of whom are here in the audience this evening. One of the people who works and has been working inside LSE Ideas for at least 2 to 3 years now is Dr. Mary Martin over here, who effectively leads what I call, broadly speaking, our United Nations program. Now, we're here to do two things tonight, I think. One is, and I reminded Mary of this, of course, when you write a book, Mary, you've got to push it. So Mary has just written a new book, which is just out, called Corporate Peace, How Global Business Shapes a Hostile World. Very, very reasonably priced, I should point out. And so I hope that you will all be buying one and making a good holiday for Mary possible in the near future. So Mary, congratulations on writing a book. I know what it's like writing books. I think many people in this audience knows what it's like writing books. It is hard work. It is painful. So congratulations. I think it's a great achievement. So very, very well done. The second purpose tonight is, of course, to debate many of the themes in the book under the generic title of Conditions for Change, Working with the Private Sector to Improve Peace and Security. Each of the four speakers, starting with Mary, will speak for about 10 minutes on some of the themes, talk to some of the themes. What I've got down here basically is durable solutions to conflict, underdevelopment and humanitarian crises require new alliances between diverse and non-traditional actors from the private sector, government and civil society, and also what should the role of the academy be in encouraging and supporting such partnerships. And we're very lucky here tonight to have a terrific panel of speakers, beginning with Mary, moving on to Sam Muslam, who works with MasterCard's vice chairman. I won't say any more about you, Sam. Selena here is the senior director for policy and advocacy at Mercy Corps. And Thomas Wheeler is a conflict advisor to my immediate left at the Department of International Development. So this is all being recorded this evening. It will be made into a podcast, and please, could you, when you finish, fill out your feedback form. So with no further ado, I wonder if you could give a nice LSE welcome to Mary Martin to begin the discussion this evening. Mary, over to you, please.
Thank you, Mick. Thank you for that introduction. I hope everybody can hear me. As you can hear, my voice has gone slightly AWOL, so apologies. But I will try and get to the back of the room as well as the front. So my job, I guess speaking first, is to perhaps provide some context to this conversation. And as you've heard, we've got speakers on the panel who aren't just from the private sector, but also other key, what I always call today, stakeholders in government and civil society. And I suppose the backdrop to this conversation is the progressive shift that we have seen from the state as the sole provider of key public goods. And here tonight we're talking about public goods in terms of security, development, how you respond to crises, whether they're environmental, humanitarian, and some other sort. And I think this shift in the role, the relative role of the state, has been just the starting point. It clearly began with some decades ago with trying to outsource public policy and delivery of goods. So you had things like public-private partnerships. And when I and my colleagues go around the world and we try and talk about our new idea of partnerships and as transformative, we always get back like a sort of ping-pong ball. Oh, you're talking about public-private partnerships. Well, no, I'm not, because I want you to kind of almost erase that from your minds. I think what we're talking about now are quite different sorts of coalitions. And in these coalitions, non-state actors are seen as very natural, not strange, bedfellows of governments in areas including security and development, which were once obviously pretty much sole preserve of states. So we're moving beyond, if you like, this public-private partnership idea to a much more fundamental realignment of capacities and interests to tackle these very complex areas. Why? Why are we sort of moving in the next step beyond? I'll give you two reasons, but I think there are probably several more, and you may hear this from other members of the panel tonight. I think particularly in places where conflict and crisis abound, and they're the result of government dysfunction or government absence, other actors from civil society, organizations or business, often have better access, they have access, full stop, and they often have more legitimacy to deal with the problems that confront both local community, international community, and national government. Even the private sector, which often arouses a lot of controversy and hostility in these places, may be seen as less legitimate, but it is often present, and it remains so after the state often has been forced to retreat. So I think that's why these coalitions have started to be more thought about and articulated. And I think another reason is that what we're seeing on the part of the private sector is an increased willingness to engage in humanitarian response, in local development issues, certainly in climate change initiatives, and in peace building. So I'm talking about a kind of positive terrain here, which is beyond kind of compliance with rules and regulations. And I think this is part of a wider picture of public pressure, which is certainly being seen, particularly on large companies, on global companies, to be more socially responsible and to contribute to what is now fashionably called sustainability. We can debate what that is. But I think there is this public momentum, which goes along with public opprobrium often of the private sector, that there is an opening for these kind of interventions. So the consequences you have of this increased engagement and possibility is the growth of some novel kinds of alliances, whether they're ad hoc coalitions or formal partnerships. But what you get in them is very different kinds of actors having to work together. And I think what's notable about these kind of arrangements is that there is a structure, a different structure to how security and development is done on the ground and in everyday life. I'm not talking about high-level diplomacy or sort of public policy here. It's a very kind of practical effort. And we can talk about development, or we can talk about humanitarian crises or responses, But obviously they're very broad headings, and within that you've got lots of smaller initiatives, say on education, on the environment, on health, poverty, women's inclusion, and so on. And I think these are all kind of focal points around which different actors can coalesce. And I think the other novel thing about these new arrangements, collaborative arrangements, is that they do in the end change public policy, because they're kind of remaking how it's done on the ground. I think you'll all be aware of the SDG, the UN's SDG agenda, how ambitious and enormous that is leading up to 2030. The bill for it is variously estimated at trillions. $24 trillion is one figure that's often used. And clearly that cannot be achieved just by targeting government budgets alone. It needs the private sector. So again, you've got an opening for new kinds of collaborative arrangements. When you get these coalitions, these alliances, what's different about them? I say I'm focusing really here on the transformative potential. It's clearly not always realised, but it is there. I think they can change outcomes by combining different sorts of resources and leveraging synergies between them, and also by changing relationships, how things happen between key different actors, whether they're actors who make things happen, whether they're communities to whom things are being done. But the important thing is different actor alliances can change relationships on the ground. And I think the fundamental difference, if I had to put it in one phrase, from what we've had before in, say, the era of public-private partnership to these kind of coalitions for change, is the transformative nature of the landscape that they can have. They're not transactional partnerships. They aim, at least, to be transformative. And, of course, they're both global and local. Some of the work that we're doing through this program at LSE Ideas is in Colombia with five municipalities that are most affected by conflict, and working with a combination of local businesses, national businesses, international companies, government at every level, and local communities and civil society organizations. So you can see it's a sort of mosaic. And getting those kind of different actors to dialogue, to understand each other, and to come to an outcome that is beneficial for all of them, that is not sort of charitable, philanthropic, or public money, but is actually durable because it's rooted in what people have an interest and the capacity in delivering, is really important. And let me just finally say, because Mick mentioned another important category, and I'm sitting here as an academic, so the academy is also part of this kind of multi-actor alliance of different interests that has the potential to bring about change. And academics can play very different roles. There's obviously a research capacity, because we sitting here in a university and, of course, in a think tank would say that everything needs to be evidence-based, and we do believe in experts. We don't believe in just making public policy on the hoof. So clearly academics can contribute that, and often you'll find academics who are using particular methodologies where they're much more participatory with their subjects. But I think you also see some interesting examples on the ground, and some of my colleagues in the Latin America and Caribbean Center have done interesting work in Mexico and Colombia, where they've used what they call pracademics. So they're using academics as independent, neutral, and again trusted and legitimate participants and interlocutors who can help this gel these strange sort of working alliances between very different actors. They can mentor and facilitate that dialogue. And I think that's a really useful and perhaps a much more risky for an academic, but an important part of their function, particularly on the ground in local levels. So I will stop before my voice does, okay. and let others give, hopefully, I'm sure, some good examples.
Right, thanks very much, Mary. That's great. We'll move then on, in terms of the order, we've got it on the agenda tonight, to Sam, who works, again, just to repeat, with MasterCard's vice chairman supporting their work. So, Sam, over to you, if you could just use the mic.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very
much.
There we
go. Hopefully that will work.
Your voice is still there.
Okay. So... probably kind of worth explaining kind of what MasterCard does, because and why we're actually here kind of contributing to this discourse. Can I just get a show of hands for those people that have a MasterCard branded card in their wallet or linked to their phone? Okay, quite a few, not all of you, maybe our kind of salespeople need to do a slightly better job. But now, most people think that those cards are issued by MasterCard, but they're not. They're issued by a financial institution. So you might be with Monzo or Starling if you're, you know, with a Neobank or Royal Bank of Scotland or Lloyds and so on. But what MasterCard does is we're primarily a technology company that works in the payment space. So we connect... about 30,000 financial institutions to over 60 million merchants that allows about 3 billion cards or mobile connected devices to run across our network every day. And so our business at its core has always been built on partnerships. And so what we've been doing for about 10 years is trying to figure out how we can use our technology, our know-how, our network for social impact. And this is not what we would say is just kind of pure philanthropy, as Mary talked about. These are kind of what we refer to as commercially sustainable social impact. And the real kind of our real kind of entry into this field started in about 2014, where we made a commitment to include 500 million people that were currently excluded from the world's formal financial systems and bring them in. Because there'd been lots of research by the World Bank and other organisations that said that financial inclusion is a really good cornerstone for economic growth for those communities at the base of the pyramid. We thought, well, that's a great thing to be able to do. But also from our perspective, we're thinking that's 500 million new customers. Now, maybe today they're only putting through 50 cents a week through their products, which actually will be kind of very little income for us. But when it becomes $50 and $500, as those communities grow through financial inclusion, be part of that process, then they become valuable customers for us as well. So we kind of label this our kind of doing well by doing good philosophy. And actually what we found, and now we're pretty much on the cusp of bringing those 500 million people into the formal financial systems. And that has been, again, all through partnerships. And that can be with governments, with NGOs, with business and academia. Now, primarily, we started off working with governments. Because to bring 500 million people in, governments control kind of regulation in terms of, you know, how what kind of financial systems you can have access to. But governments are a really good funding source. So whenever they've been previously giving out cash, disbursements, whether it's for pensions and payroll or for its child benefits or farming subsidies, we work with governments to digitize those processes. So again, over many years, really strong evidence for us that partnerships with governments can have a social impact and also a really positive business impact for us as well. And again, as kind of Mary alluded to, now there's been a much stronger focus on a much wider set of objectives. So if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, all 17 of them, MasterCard is actively looking at where can we kind of legitimately play a role? What kind of things can we solve for? And we've really started to think about what our role is in terms of the types of partnerships that we have. So we know that the private sector has a lot of capital. But we're not just interested in people coming to talk to us because they want us to write a nice fat check and then off we go and they'll do something with it. But it's really our technology and our expertise and the new business models, which is where we think the role of the private sector can be most influential. And then the other actors, the NGOs, will have their sphere of expertise, and I'm not going to talk about that because I'm sure Selena can. The same with governments and academia as well. But we've looked at all of them and the strengths of each, and we figured out this is how we best partner. And so I'm going to talk about a couple of examples of partnerships that have worked really well, which is beyond just some of the working with governments. So one of them, for example, we've done with DFID is a program called Transform. Now, that was originally set up with Unilever, and its aim was to improve the lives of low-income households by unlocking access to markets that they were previously excluded from, and a target to achieve that with 100 million people by 2025. And their focus is on health, livelihoods, and the environment. Now, we've been working with Unilever for quite a while because, again, another focus for us is figuring out, again, how we can work to build these kind of new business models. And if you look in places like Kenya, for example, every village has got a corner shop. They're called dukas. There's about 60,000 of them. And one of the challenges that all of these shopkeepers have is that because they live in a cash economy, they find it very difficult to access credit. Most of these people are women, so they don't even have access to any collateral. They don't own property because culturally it's not acceptable, even though legally it is. But what you do have with all of these stores is this trading history with Unilever. So for years and years and years, every week they've been buying, you know, soap powder and washing up liquid and various other things that they've been selling in their store. The challenge is they've only been able to buy from Unilever with whatever cash they happen to have on themselves at that time. But we said, well, look, it's obviously a viable business because it's been going for many years. So we basically digitized the that supply chain information. We served it up to the banks and said, actually, this looks like it's a pretty viable business. Are you willing to lend to them based on this supply chain history? And they have been able to do that. And so this is what we would call like a business-business partnership between ourselves and Unilever and the banks. We've seen those shops increase their revenues by an average of about 30%, which has again had a huge impact on those communities in which they operate. And so then the role for DFID in this through Transform has been when we think about actually for the first time, lots of these shopkeepers have got access to credit. So what does that mean? What's the impact of making sure that you keep on time with, you know, with paying these kind of small loans back? Because not only is there potentially an impact if you, it's not like borrowing from your uncle or from your brother or your sister and you say, well, I'll pay you next month. You need to be quite regular. And now there's a negative impact of not being regular, but also there's a positive impact because then you build up a formal credit history with the bank. So then when you want to borrow for a mortgage, to buy some more land and so on, not just for buying more goods from Unilever, you've got that credit history. So all of this is education that these shopkeepers didn't have before. And what DFID have funded through the Transform program is a small SME called Everyone Mobile that delivers this information through mobile networks to these shopkeepers, so giving them a range of business skills as well as credit, but it's just more around business management and so on. So again, each of these actors has a different role to play, and we're really happy that we can, you know, from MasterCard, from a private sector perspective, can play its role. Now, I've got lots more examples here that I could go through in terms of partnerships with universities and with NGOs and so on, but maybe if I kind of leave it there for now, and maybe I can come back to some of those examples.
That's great, Sam. Well, okay. We can pick up a lot of that in the Q&A. And move on then quickly to Selina, Senior Director for Policy and Advocacy at Mercy Corp. Selina, over to you.
Thank you. These chairs rather encourage leaning in a sort of re-smog.
Re-smog here. Though.
Thank you. So, good evening. My name is Selina Vogter. Mercy Corps, if you're not aware of our organisation, is a global aid organisation. We do a lot of humanitarian work. About 40-50% of our work is responding to humanitarian crises. But we're somewhat unusual in that we also work on the causes of those crises with a particular focus on peace building. So we do a lot of work in the conflict and violence space, which is sometimes a little tricky to know as an organisation. And partnerships of all stripes are fundamental to kind of Mercy Corps' vision of how we're going to achieve this sort of transformative level change. And that includes with the private sector. So we have partnerships on sort of multiple levels. I mean, I think today we're looking mainly at the sort of with the big multinationals, with the big corporates. But actually our work with the local private sector is critical to a lot of what we do, whether that is about how we're delivering response, about working with the private sector for a sort of market-based response to humanitarian crisis, or even working with small businesses to prepare for humanitarian crisis. So they're ready to tool up, they're ready to pivot what they're providing and cope with a flood or a conflict or a disaster and be able to respond better. And part of the driver of that is we've done a lot of research in different contexts, but most recently in Syria, about what makes people most resilient and most able to cope with, in that case, 7 years of conflict. And it was access to a functioning market was much more critical to their ability to cope and adapt than access to humanitarian aid, which is depressing for the aid industry, but is a useful, is a very useful data point. We also, as well as our sort of formal partnerships with the private sector, we do a lot to engage them and to exert influence. Because it was interesting what you said, Mary, and this comes up a lot, that the SDGs is going to cost X trillion. We need the private sector to kick in. Is the private sector really going to hand out that kind of money to the work of people like us? It's not on a par with what we get from governments. But ultimately, their changes to their own behaviours can contribute far more, I think, to achieving those goals than any kind of any checks they can write. So Mercy Corps' relationship with the private sector has changed, particularly with the multinationals, has changed a lot in the last 20 years. I mean, we began with those traditional kind of CSR philanthropy budgets, where essentially they paid us and we delivered programs that we were going to deliver anyway. But that has, particularly over the sort of last 5 or 6 years, has moved to a much deeper 360-degree relationship, often with corporate plus government plus local partners plus institutions like LSE Ideas, to bring our own expertise, skills to the table. So it's often a financial transaction because NGOs can't do anything without being funded, but it's often more than that. And the successful ones are increasingly based on a really frank discussion about shared value. And it's really nice having MasterCard here being just very clear and frank about this has to be commercially viable too. Right? If it's not going to make a profit, it's not sustainable. It's nice as a piece of philanthropy, but it has to have shared value. And one example I wanted to talk about, which might raise a few eyebrows, is our relationship with Shell. Over the past sort of 10 years, I think 2010, we first took funding from them. And this is not the foundation, this is Shell International, the oil company. And early on, it was a very traditional relationship. They funded us for emergency response. We worked with them in Somalia. We worked with them in Nigeria, which is interesting. They supported our livelihoods work, our humanitarian work. But a couple of years ago, we sat down to really think through what a shared value partnership might look like. And we did, of course, look to their kind of CSR philanthropic aims, which are around access to energy and sustainable job creation. But we also looked at the corporate aims, which include increasing their profile for their investments in and commitment to renewables. Now, Mercy Corps has a huge interest in access to sustainable energy. The communities we work with are often the poorest, the most marginalised, the least likely to have access to good infrastructure, and very often displaced. And in a displacement setting, access to energy is not only, you know, to provide access to basic things like education and health, but competition over energy can be a driver of conflict, particularly between hosts and refugee populations. So it's a critical area for us. So we have been working on developing this partnership. And it's a two-way street. So they're funding us. They have given us in-house funding for in-house experts. They've also given us funding for a particular program in Ethiopia to create solar mini-grids for humanitarian operations in schools and health centres in Ethiopia. And we are working with them on developing their own strategy on sustainable access to energy and humanitarian settings, which is ultimately going to be a business. It's going to create a financial return. it hasn't been a straightforward relationship. It's terrific, and we're doing some really interesting work with them. But of course, there's been challenges around that sort of fundamental tension of different objectives. Even when you do the work to identify that shared value proposition, that doesn't take away various other kind of conflicting interests that are always going to come up and cause tension. And sometimes those might be deeply controversial. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're just practical. You know, what if Mercy Corps wants to access the most vulnerable people, whereas Shell wants to access the most people who are vulnerable? It's different populations. So there are tensions around that. And of course, there are reputational risks. You know, that could be in general to be connected to an extractive. It could be in a specific context, Nigeria. You know, there may be places where it's very difficult for us to work with Shell, and vice versa, to be honest. And we have an extensive due diligence process, but this is a huge corporation with partners and subcompanies. And so, you know, the chance of us knowing everything that's going on, and of course things change. There are risks on both sides, but it has been an incredibly sort of useful and interesting partnership. I just wanted to touch on one other, because I think it might raise other eyebrows. Just, I thought it'd be controversial tonight. We have a terrific relationship with Cisco, the tech company, who give us a huge pot of funding to kind of develop technological solutions to some of the humanitarian challenges. And it's been completely transformative, and they're a fabulous donor. And one of the areas that they've been funding us to do is to look at the digital drivers of conflict, the weaponization of social media. We do a huge amount of peace building IRL, but to look at how that works online and what someone like Mercy Corps, how our expertise could be used in that space. Now, the second phase of that is funded by Facebook. So they're funding us. They're not currently partnering with us, but we hope we will be partnering with them and with all the other social media companies to really look at what that does, how hate speech is working, how that's translating, what's happening around fake news, manipulation of elections. You know, that's quite a controversial area. We think it's more effective to do it in partnership with Cisco and Facebook and others, but are there challenges around that? Of course there are. And we have to make sure we're not naive and that we're savvy and we have the right expertise to properly be at the table. I think that's enough controversy for tonight.
Okay, Selena, I'm sure we'll get one or two little questions around both Shell and Cisco. And last but by no means least, Thomas Wheeler, conflict advisor at the Department of International Development. Tom, over to you.
Great, thanks. I'll start with a caveat that I'll sort of speak mostly in a personal capacity of my own views. It means I can be a little bit less boring and maybe enter some of the controversy, but also speak to some previous experience working with NGOs. Just a few comments on building partnerships around peace building in fragile states. Where I work in different now, fragile states and conflict is one of, if not the biggest, development issues that we face. So our own analysis tells us that about 80% of the world's poor by 2030 will be in fragile and conflict-affected states. That's where extreme poverty is going to be found. So for DFID at the moment, we are going through a big process of focusing more on these contexts. But it's also clear, you know, that for civil society and for the private sector, fragile and conflict are also issues, and that clearly we all have a shared agenda around peace building. I think I want to think about sort of three different ways in which especially governments can support civil society and the private sector. So the first is simply supporting them to do what they do best. The second is around managing risk. And then the third is around how we go the extra mile to build peace. So in doing what they do best, I mean, we know for a fact, the evidence tells us that accountable institutions, open political spaces are really important for long-term stability, and that civil society plays a really important role in that, especially local, national civil society. So, for example, there's quite strong evidence around the role of women's groups in accountability. Governments can support this in two main ways. One way is we sort of engage on the enabling environment, so engage on legislation or build ways in which civil society can hold governments account or hold our own programs accountable. But the other way we can do it is through direct partnership with civil society groups. So, for example, in Zimbabwe, DFID provides capacity building and small amounts of funding to media and civil society activists. I think some of that direct partnership can be challenging. There was a report recently by the Institute for Development Studies that's really, really good if you're interested on this stuff, called Action for Empowerment and Accountability. And there are three challenges on how governments partner with civil society in fragile states that I thought were really, really stood out. The one is that these are often really dangerous environments, and they're often spaces where there's closed civil space. And I think donors have to be really sensitive to what our partnerships are like with civil society, because you can sometimes do more harm. Also, sometimes local civil society don't necessarily want to partner with international actors. Sometimes this undermines their legitimacy. So I was really struck when I found out that in Nigeria, the Bring Back Our Girls campaign actually refused to take any international funding because they thought it was really important that they didn't partner with international actors. On the private sector, again, you know, the private sector doing what it does best can be actually a really significant contribution to stability over the long term. So providing jobs and livelihoods for people. In Somalia, we work with companies there trying to do investments in sort of agriculture and fishing and livestock and poultry, all kinds of jobs, aiming to create about 10,000, 9,000 to 10,000 jobs, including especially jobs for women is something we're trying to focus on. Also paying taxes for the private sector. Again, in Somalia, some of the work that's been really interesting is exploring dialogue between companies in the ICT sector, mobile phone sector, and with the government, and exploring how we can support dialogue with them on the what can be a really thorny question of taxation and the taxes they pay. There are challenges, again, on working with the private sector, especially in contexts like Somalia. It can sometimes be very difficult as a government to disentangle the private sector from politicians and from the elite and from power structures. And in some ways, you know, there's also, because of that blurred line between the private sector and the state and the government and political actors or conflict actors, in some ways private sector action can make conflict worse. Which links to the second point, which is around managing risks. So doing what we do, but trying to manage risks. Essentially what we call, you know, conflict sensitivity, where both, and this applies to donors, it applies to NGOs, and it applies to the private sector, which is understanding the context we work in and understanding the risk that our actions impact negatively on that context, even when our intentions are good, and taking actions to address those. One of the things we've done in contexts like South Sudan and others is building resource facilities. Often there are facilities that are run by NGOs, often sometimes with local NGOs, that provide advice both to donors, to DFID as a donor and to other governments, but also to NGOs, to the UN and implementing partners all the way down the chain through all of our aid programs to ensure that they really understand the context that they're working in and they're managing some of the risks that they fuel conflict. This also applies to the private sector. So if you're doing infrastructure construction, if you're developing land, if you're in the extractive sector, as Selena mentioned, there are really big risks that you end up fueling conflict. So about, I read 60% of disputes related to private sector land investments in Africa all began with disputes over communities being displaced from that land. I worked in South Sudan quite a few years ago with Chinese companies, where I was working with an NGO and we were partnering with Chinese companies on how they manage some of these risks. And it was really interesting because in Beijing at a headquarter level, they kind of didn't want to engage on conflict sensitivity and these kind of issues. They felt it was quite political. But at the operation level on the ground, some of these companies were actually, they really understood the operating environment they were in. They really understood the risks and they really understood how what they were doing interacted with that. And in some ways, in a very ad hoc way, but they were taking actions like engaging with local communities, trying to resolve some of the disputes. So there's this almost this organic action on the ground. And I think a lesson for me there is how partnership on very different levels can mean very different things. And Selena mentioned, I think there's a huge role for NGOs on working with companies on that. And then just finally, you know, so we can do, you know, companies, civil society do what they do. There's ways of managing risk, but there's also going the extra mile and making peace building a really an explicit outcome of what you're trying to do. So there's lots of civil society organizations that are explicitly peace-building organizations, but there's also big multi-mandate international NGOs like Mercy Corps that are increasingly looking to work more explicitly on conflict issues, and I think that's really positive. Some of the interesting work that DFID's done is on supporting very local civil society actors on peace processes. So again, in South Sudan, where I was just a few months ago, we did some really interesting work with the South Sudan, with the Council of Churches, which are really impartial, respected, and quite an influential voice in South Sudan. And they do really great work on public awareness around conflict issues, on dealing with divisions between communities. But they're also really engaged in very elite-level peace process negotiations between the government and the armed opposition. And it hasn't really been UK funding which has allowed them to do that work, and that's been part of it, but it's been more the political support. And it's a political partnership with groups, with those kind of civil society groups, making sure they're at the table, making sure we equip them with the knowledge and skills that they can engage in these high-level negotiations, mobilizing our own diplomatic network to support them. And for me, the lesson around that kind of a partnership with civil society isn't necessarily about the funding, but it's about the sort of political element we can bring. And Mary, you mentioned a few cases of the private sector engaging in peace processes. And even though it's not that common, it's more common than you imagine. So, for example, in Kenya, the private sector really came out after the post-election violence to lobby for peace. In Sri Lanka, there was business associations really engaged on pushing for peace talks. In Northern Ireland, the Northern Irish wing of the CBI and other associations were really engaged on the peace process, building links across the border and also using their collective power and influence to promote peace talks. In Somaliland, it was, I think, as I understand, it was the private sector who paid for peace talks themselves within that context. So there's lots and lots of examples of this. But I think while governments are getting better at engaging with civil society on their role in peace processes, I think there's probably more that we could do around the role of companies and their role there. And it would be interesting to hear more examples on how we could support that. Again, I had a few other thoughts, but I'll save them.
We could pick those up in the Q&A. Mary, I'm going to quote something from your book just to maybe throw something in. On page 188, you wrote it, not me. The private sector has not shaken off the pervasive distrust that motivated first anti-globalization demonstrations, then the Occupy movement, and subsequently the Extinction Rebellions, etc. And because all of you touched on that in a way. I mean, is it a legitimate distrust? And secondly, how and why, or how should it be overcome? Maybe throw that one, just as, because it did seem to me as a theme that, you know, something that everybody touched, and I know a lot of people in the audience will raise the same question. Yeah. Is the private sector basically part of the problem, not really part of the solution, or is it both? So what's your own reflection? Did you come to any strong conclusions like that in your book to start off with?
I mean, I think books have been written. Sorry. I could certainly have written a whole book on corporate abuses, as I think you all mentioned. You know, companies are often conflict drivers, both wittingly, and I think Tom mentioned, or somebody mentioned, the complicity that you have between dysfunctional or abusive governments and elites in the private sector. Particularly in this book, where I wanted to talk about was, you know, that there is another side to things, and I think it's a side that companies themselves often don't fully recognise, which is for having positive impacts. And I mean, the two don't cancel each other out. Mm. I think there is often, I mean, we're working in Colombia. This is a very good example where the private sector was specifically invited in by the government that settled the peace agreement to contribute to the post-colonial transformation. Four years on, most of them are left scratching their heads about what role exactly they should play in that. Meanwhile, in a lot of the communities, one of the five that we're working in, there is massive mistrust because the company that's a big company that's present there is building a dam, and the dam is regularly flooding their land and causing environmental disaster, depriving them of their livelihoods. And, you know, to go into that and say, oh, you can have a partnership where we just talk about how we can all work beautifully together, clearly is sort of being Canute-like. However, at the same time, what I touched on in my remarks, I think that there is a sort of perverse, if I can call it that, also underlying faith, maybe, at the same time as mistrust and distrust, there is a perverse faith at the community level often in what companies can do and deliver. And often it's a sort of relationship, it's an equation between how bad the government or how absent the government has been and what they see as maybe companies being able to do. So what I see is partly, I mean, the work we're doing there is partly about teaching or helping people to understand each other's language and find that common ground where there is an overlap of interests, where they don't need necessarily to be in total confrontation, without denying the fact that, you know, there are important issues of...
I'll ask everybody to try to reflect. Thanks, Mary, that's good. Sam, do you want to say anything on that one?
Yeah, just... Yeah, I think I was kind of read a kind of piece of research recently. There's a management theorist called Michael Porter, and he says that kind of corporates have gone kind of to three stages of kind of thinking about their engagement with society. And so basically they started off where companies basically, well, at least some of them did bad things, and then they would build a museum or a hospital and so on to kind of absolve themselves of their sins. And then it kind of evolved a bit, and so we had a big focus on things like corporate sustainable responsibility. And so that was basically the idea that companies should try not to do bad things, right? Don't pollute the rivers and kind of cut your emissions, and then you've kind of got all this, you know, anti-slavery legislation and all these kinds of things as well. And then he says, like, the third stage is where businesses are actually looking at how can they make their core business have a positive social impact. And I think part of the challenge we have with this kind of dynamic and this relationship is we're kind of, it's not that there has been a continuum like that was, you know, 1920, then 1980, and then now. There's kind of an overlapping situation here. So not all businesses are squeaky clean. We know that there are challenges and so on. So there is the, you know, a need for the private sector to demonstrate the fact that it's trustworthy, it has to do the right things. And that will only be shown through its actions, you know, kind of what, how is the private sector demonstrating that it's behaving kind of responsibly? And I think that, I mean, I'm speaking from the private sector, so obviously I'd say, well, I think there's lots of evidence that we are. But it was one of the reasons that I joined MasterCard, because when I looked at the business and I looked at what it did, it was clear to me that from the top, from the CEO, right the way through the organisation, there are people that are determined that they should have a positive impact on society. And, you know, people talk about kind of, you know, well, millennials only want to work for companies these days that have a positive impact. So if you look at businesses from a recruitment perspective, if you want to attract best minds in the world, you have to be a business that is being seen to have a positive impact on society. Microsoft had huge problems in the States a little while ago because of their government programs, right? And there was a huge backlash from employees, and other companies have had it too. So I think actually companies are having to think about the work that they do and the way that they operate in terms of from just being purely commercially competitive. And then what happens is, well, those employees that felt like that and the reason that they joined, they rise through the ranks of the company. And then actually you end up with a leadership team that thinks that way as well. So I think these changes are definitely, definitely happening. But it's not it's not the same everywhere.
No. When you were talking, I was thinking of the history of the Rockefeller Foundation. I mean, John D. Rockefeller, the founder of Standard Oil, didn't pay a cent of tax and had a complete monopoly, as you know, over the whole of the oil business in the United States. And he found a way out of it. One was partly praying a lot. But more importantly, he gave a vast amount of his wealth away. And, you know, there's a big debate about philanthropy. Was it simply his way of deodorizing the fact he hadn't been paying too much tax? The way of legitimizing the Rockefeller, or did it actually do good? And in a sense, it was all of the three, it was all of the above. And it did do a lot of good. It did an enormous amount of good in terms of eliminating disease in the South in the United States, what it's done over the years. It's given away billions over the years. And by the way, in the 1920s, it funded the LSE by 25%, so we shouldn't be too critical of the Rockefeller. So just in case. But it's an interesting kind of analogy, I think, kind of thinking about the role of philanthropy itself.
Absolutely. You know? And actually, there's just one thing I wanted to mention as well, just like purely from a kind of MasterCard kind of perspective as well, is that I think for us as a company, I said, like, for the last 10 years, this has been an area that we've been focused on, really, since we IPO'd in 2009. And what the company did then was it took 10% of its stock, and from that we set up the MasterCard Foundation. Now, back then, you know, we were worth $5 billion, so that was a nice $500 million foundation. Now that we're worth $320 billion, that has grown to $32 billion, so one of the biggest foundations in the world. And what was really interesting that they did, the legal construct, was that the core business is not allowed to have any influence over what the foundation does. So we're not allowed to, it can only engage in activities that benefit the commercial side of the business. It's completely not allowed. So if you look at what they've invested in, it's almost entirely on education in Africa. And actually now they realise that actually education's a bit pointless if there are no jobs at the end of it. So actually it's education linked with work. And so again, we've been working with governments. So actually you see that within our DNA. And then another piece of evidence for me was when Trump gave those massive tax cuts to corporate America a kind of a couple of years ago.
They pay for themselves.
Well, yes. Well, that's what he claims. Yeah. And but then what we did was we basically took $500 million from that tax cut and we put it into our Center for Inclusive Growth. So this is kind of the philanthropy arm that is more closely tied to the business. So it isn't required to engage in activities that provide a commercial return, but, for example, we'll engage in thought leadership that looks at, actually, there's something that's about to be published with LSE, which is on the impact of political violence and uprisings in countries like Egypt and Tunisia and so on, and what that means for tourism and for low-skilled workers. You know, well, we're interested in tourism and interested in the impact of the economy. So we see that time and time again through the business. Now, we're doing it. We're not the only company that's doing that. And there are many, many more.
Selena, do you want to come in on that as well, please? Yeah. Finally on Thomas.
I will. I mean, I certainly recognise it. And I think it's quite interesting. I mean, I think as a, you know, liberal elite, post-Brexit, there's a certain disdain, actually. It's not just distrust, it's a disdain for the corporate sector whilst enjoying all the benefits of capitalism. So I think there is a certain hypocrisy in it all. But I think it is very important that we make the distinction in some ways between the corporations we're dealing with in a very privileged West, where we have a functioning media, a very active social media. There is so much more transparency around the activities of companies now in our context than there ever has been. And I feel like this debate about whether we're moving towards stakeholder capitalism rather than maximizing shareholder value. Isn't really a debate, because you can only maximise shareholder value by being relatively squeaky clean, because you will get found out and you will be made to pay if you're polluting, if you're committing human rights abuses. But I think that's quite specific to the kind of context, the sort of free democracies that we're lucky enough to live in. I think that's a lot harder in some of the work we might be doing in Congo or in fragile states where there is not that same sort of balance of power. I think, though, even with the large corporations, our biggest problem is naivety. I think
theirs or yours?
Ours.
Yeah.
Ours. Absolutely. Maybe theirs. But, you know, going into a relationship, assuming that everybody's there with the same objectives, that there's no other agenda, that they don't have, you know, they don't have to deliver on their obligations to their shareholders, that they don't have a larger agenda. You know, any work we do with a huge multinational corporation, I think we need to be super savvy and frank about that, and not just sort of pretend it's a, gloss over it all.
Thomas, last
yeah. I think, just at the top, not underestimating just the important role that the private sector can play in creating jobs for people in some of these contexts. Like, it's really, really demanded and really needed in these places. That said, of course, there are ways in which the private sector, can do harm, and especially in contexts of conflict. The solutions around that, I would say primarily sit with local governments, with the national governments. So thinking about, at a macro level, how do they tax companies? How do they use that revenue responsibly? How do they ensure that there's private sector growth in the right areas of the country which might feel marginalized? How do they deal with issues of compensation when people get pushed off their land, for example. But the reality is, as Mary sort of mentioned, in these contexts, the state often doesn't play that role, and there is this gap, and there's this space opens
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
And then that responsibility, you know, there's interesting questions of the burden of the responsibility, how much of that falls onto the companies, you know. And companies can do a lot in that space through, you know, corporate social responsibility or going even further through sort of complex sensitivity issues. But what are the limits of that responsibility? How far can they go? Especially as in these conflict spaces, you know, being responsible sometimes means not only really understanding political dynamics, but being quite political yourself, and how comfortable are they in that space? You know, I don't think there's easy solutions.
Well, two of you have said, and I'll open it up with just one observation. All four of you have said, but two in particular have said, the issue is not just about the corporates. It's the fact that in so many parts of the world, the state just does not do what we expect states to do: public goods, social welfare, hospitals, and all the rest of it. So that is maybe a much bigger problem than maybe identifying the corporates as being the problem, I wonder. I mean, I'm not saying it's either or, but maybe it's a bit of both.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's open it up now to some questions and answers. We have a microphone, just the one. LSC is clearly not its uppers at the moment. Can we... Yeah, well, come down the side here, Dave. I think over here, lady over here. Could you put your hand up? Hand up, please. Who's had a hand up? Everybody had a hand up. There's only a gentleman over here. Okay, we've got a gentleman there. Gentleman, please, sir. Over to you.
Yeah, thank you all very much. The name's Ewan Grant. I've worked for international organisation tax reform projects, East Africa, Yemen. I'm a shareholder in Shell and Unilever. My question is, how is everyone, governments, private sector and NGOs, adjusting to the arrival big time of China and Russia, particularly, I think, in relation to the point was made about land grabs, loss of land, into the extractive industries where, let's be clear, particularly in the case of Russia, where you see the extractive industries, you very quickly see the likes of Wagner. In fact, you might see them first. And I suspect in increasing years, we may well see the Chinese equivalent of Wagner turning up with perhaps issues for peacekeeping and security, but also on tax and revenue. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. So that's a general question about the role of Russia, China, how they enter. Let's just hold on to that one. There's a lady over here, please. Yeah. Just say who you are.
Hello, thank you for the talk. I'm Janine. I'm a student at LSE. I'm from Colombia, and I was a practitioner in there during the last 3 years, working with the private sector and the NGOs and the local communities. My question is related to, we know that, of course, to overcome mistrust, the business sector will have to work and get in touch with the local communities. But when we were working in Colombia, especially with the extractive sector, we found out that the social fabric was completely broken, and people, local communities, were demanding to talk or to have that dialogue directly with the high-level positions, the people who actually made the decision to invest in Colombia and to invest in a way that it was not responsible from the social perspective. So they have this mistrust, but they want to talk with the high-level positions. And actually bringing them into the table was completely difficult because, of course, the high-level positions are busy in other type of things. And so, of course, we know what we have to do, but what are the incentives that we can actually offer to the business sector, especially to the high-level positions, to bring them to the table and to actually make them be interested in having contact with the local communities.
Okay, that's great. As a gentleman over here, I take this as the third one, then we'll get some answers from the...
Thank you.
Please, sir.
Zahir Yudin from Lloyds of London, large financial services institution.
In your research and kind of analysis, do you, or how do you rather make the distinction, if there is one, between the conditions that enable private sector in a said market, so free competition, open barriers to no barriers to entry, kind of transparency in pricing, and private sector players themselves? They might not always be one and the same. You can get situations where private sector players, including multinationals, are working in a non-private sector setting, or sometimes suppressing the private sector through monopolies, etc. So how do you make that distinction?
Okay, thanks. There's some good questions there. Well, let's start on the China-Russia. What impact is that, particularly China, I think, especially, but what impact is that having on the work that you're doing, particularly on issues like conditionality and other things like that? Anybody want to pick up on that one? Anybody want to have a shot at that one at all?
Oh, go on then.
Go to
yeah, I mean, dealing with the fact that, you know, the world is not run by the US and the UK. It's probably not news. And it's something that we've become increasingly aware of and have to be a little bit humble about. It's not just an issue in relation to this, in relation to the private sector. It's an issue in relation to everything we do that engages in any way with sort of global politics. So anything around human rights, anything around the Security Council, anything around, we do a lot of work around kind of humanitarian aid in Syria, how we get access into Syria, how we respond to violations of IHL. That all has to, we have to think differently. And we, the system is not set up well to handle it, because we know how to talk to the British government, and we know how to talk to, frankly, British headquartered corporations and US headquartered corporations. And we know what the regulation are, and we know what the levers are, and we know what the kind of forms of pressure. And we've had a couple of hundred years of working on shaping those things. We're nowhere near that, with certainly not with Russia. It's changed a lot with China. The Mercy Corps has an office in China. We engage with the Chinese government, but also with Chinese corporations, and do work with them, as we also do with Gulf states. It is changing, but it is a very different culture and political setup, and I think we need to be a little bit humble and not assume that ours is only, or necessarily always, the best way, but just be aware of the kind of limitations of our influence. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but it's certainly a kind
well,
of
I'm not sure there is a clear answer to the question.
If we can answer it tonight, that would be terrific.
Yeah, I get the point. Yeah. Anybody else want to come in on that one?
I mean, just to, clearly China is playing, you know, to take the case of China, clearly China is playing a growing role in many of these places, in the places that DFID works in, so fragile conflict-affected states. In some places, you know, for example, Myanmar, China has played a very long role, and there's been long investment of China. In other places like South Sudan, there was a relationship, but it's grown a lot in the past. So it depends on different contexts. In South Sudan specifically, I remember working there with Chinese companies and with South Sudanese civil society and other stakeholders there. The history of some Chinese companies in South Sudan was not a positive one, especially oil companies. They were perceived by people to have been complicit in the war between the north and the south. The longest civil war in Africa. They were also seen as complicit in supporting the regime in Khartoum for a long time, and complicit in the displacement of people from oil fields. That was particularly one set of Chinese companies. I think, though, the things that I'd stress is, firstly, there are many different types of Chinese companies. When I was in South Sudan, there was, mum and pop, small businesses, to Chinese road companies, to others providing services. There was no one China. It wasn't a homogenous thing. And all of them had very different practices and different ways of engaging. So you can't really just put them all in one box. And the second thing was, I did see, while I was working on this, some change and some openness of Chinese companies to engage a lot more with local civil society, to really listen, to really learn. And some of those companies had, by that point, been there a long time and really did take the effort to learn local languages, engage with local communities, and some of it was quite impressive. But there was a limit. When you started engaging on issues that became political, I think it was too difficult for those companies to engage on those, and they would see that very much as something for the Chinese government to do, not for companies.
Yeah. Why don't we move on then to the second question? Mary, why don't you pick up on this, because you're not very long out of Colombia, I know. Can you maybe kick up on the Colombia question, back to the lady over here?
I feel your pain.
If you could use the mic, Mary.
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons that we started doing the work that we're doing, which is around trying to both encourage private sector engagement with issues like peace building and sustainable development, and then go beyond that to sort of structure that engagement through partnerships, what we call human security partnerships, was that clearly there is a gap. I mean, we all know that, you know, for the last, I think somebody mentioned sort of 5-6 years, perhaps longer than that, we've been filled with rhetoric about, you know, what companies are going to do. I mean, the UN Global Compact goes back to the year 2000. So there's a lot of high-level talk. And there are kind of very pragmatic solutions that go on at ground level. I mean, as you've mentioned, people from the most unlikely sources, even I would imagine, as you said, Chinese companies, which we don't think of as doing that. What we discerned, though, that there was a gap in the middle of that between this sort of rather empty rhetoric or what you read on company websites, we're doing this, that, and the other, and the very pragmatic solutions that people are doing. But somehow you need to connect both those levels. And, you know, part of it is, yes, maybe trying to get sort of management attention focused on the ground, but I think probably better is to go from the ground up, to do kind of partnerships, to do initiatives that involve kind of collaboration, and where you've got private sector businesses of every kind, small but also large, really getting stuck into the issues that matter to ordinary people, whether it's development, livelihoods, health and education, whether it's reconciliation, and then try and feed that up through the chain. And I think partnerships actually are a good way of doing that because they get noticed at senior level. Because I think even if you get companies involved in peace processes, as you said, there are examples in different countries. Again, there seems to be a disconnect between then what happens at ground level. So it was that sort of gap and that disconnect, I think, that we're particularly interested in and are trying to think, you know, what are the mechanisms by which it can go from the ground up to both national and international policymakers, but importantly up to sort of senior management and global headquarters.
But I'm not an expert on Colombia. I did go there once, and we met President Santos there, and Ideas was originally involved very much in the drugs policy. But one of the things that John Collins, who works on the drugs policy, said to me, and he lectured on this the other night too, is that the sheer distance between, you know, metropolitan Bogota, the city, and the countryside. I mean, there's no infrastructure. How do you get there? I mean, Dr. Collins was talking of, you took a plane to somewhere, then you got on a road, and then the road ended, then you got on a riverboat, which went for another 2 hours, and then finally you would arrive at the place you wanted to be at, which is where people were then, in that context, growing coca plants. So how you make move from there on the ground to there, which you were talking about, strikes me as extraordinarily difficult, given the simple lack of infrastructure and the distance between people on the ground and the elites who live in the main cities of Colombia. That's, I don't know if you found that too,
you know. You find that in lots of places, it's not a geographical thing only, it's a mindset.
It's a mindset.
Very different populations. I mean, if you go to Ukraine today, you know, that you can be in Kiev and there's no war going on. But, you know, there are businesses who are trying to solve problems in eastern Ukraine in a very pragmatic way, which, you know, may be as controversial as some of the stuff that Selena has been describing. But, I mean, these are really valuable. These are peace-building solutions. Maybe they're not scalable. Maybe they're not replicable in other countries. But, I mean, to me, that starts to point to the space that there is for, A, the private sector, and, B, mixed alliances between government, particularly, as somebody mentioned, local government, and local operators in the private sector and civil society, because it's through these kind of pragmatic solutions that you really start to get to improving people's lives, and you make a peace agreement make any kind of sense in the first place.
Did you want to come in on the private sector? The last question, maybe pick up on that, and then anything you want to do, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly different for us, I suppose, because we don't have massive infrastructure projects that have that kind of impact on people's lives, but it's still really important for us to be close to those communities that we're developing solutions from. So when we look at how we kind of develop our products and services, for example, we don't just develop everything in the US and then think that's fine to roll it out throughout the world. So, for example, we have a labs in Nairobi in Kenya, and the focus of that labs, which was started with funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as well, is to develop solutions in Africa by Africans for Africans. So this idea of being close to the consumers is a really, really important one for us. And that means also that our senior leaders also go on those visits as well. So when in South Africa, we rolled out a huge program to deliver social disbursements, my boss, who's the vice chairman, was stood in line with her MasterCard, with a long line of other, you know, Africans with their benefits to figure out how it worked in the local stores. Because then you can take that feedback back to the top of the house. So it's less of an issue in terms of, I guess, complaints and challenges, but the need to understand what your communities are going through is something that we think, if we want to be a successful business, that's absolutely what we have to be able to do.
Any other comments that anybody wants to make from here? Yes, Lee.
Yeah, I think you. Thank you. Just to add to what.
Sorry, it'll be fine.
Mary was saying. I think that disconnect between sort of headquarters and local operation can be very useful in some cases. Because what we haven't talked about is sometimes the risk and challenges for the corporation connecting with the type of work that we're talking about. I am on the board of a fund called GSURF, which is a relatively small global fund that funds local level action around preventing some of the drivers of violent extremism. You know, what drives youth to be vulnerable to recruitment, to participate in political violence. And it works very much at the local level. Now, that should be very appealing to a lot of corporations. Who doesn't want to get involved with that? But at a headquarters level, is that something they really want to have on their website and sell to the board? Do they want to be connected with the concept of violent extremism? Do they want to be in that conversation? It's fine if it's packaged as, let's empower young people, let's build governance, let's build a thriving civil society, build opportunities, but it's very different if you package it around something connected with violent extremism, even just having those words connected to your sort of corporate brand. And I think that creates a certain amount of challenges, and that's where sometimes local action or engagement with the local office of Diageo or Anglo-American or one of the slightly more evolved corporations could be more effective actually than that headquarters relationship.
Yeah, okay. Right, we've got time to take a few more questions, of course. There's a gentleman at the front I'm seeing here. Anybody else over here? I'm going to pick up. I'll take a gentleman here and then somebody behind. Yeah, please, sir.
Hello, and thank you for the talk. My name's Will Davis. I'm in the British Army. I'm attached to Chatham House at the moment for a few months. And my question is about the British Army and other armed forces operating in these sorts of environments, so peacekeeping, peace building, capacity building, etc. And in terms of your views on how they fit into this coalition for change, and whether there are institutional or cultural barriers to them getting fully involved in the process. But also, if I may just very quickly, secondly, for Thomas, from your experience, from a DFID point of view, you've mentioned conflict sensitivity. My hunch is, from experience, that the Army doesn't necessarily, I'm talking about British Army now, so reach out to understand the context in the way you describe. Now, I might be wrong, but I'd be grateful for your views on whether they tap into the private sector, the public sector, and NGOs.
Thanks for that contribution, Will. And there's somebody else over there. We'll take two. Yep, go back. Yep. Thank you very much. Hi.
Julia Ring from LSE Ideas. My question is directly to Selena, but I'm sure anyone else can potentially jump in. I'm interested in the relationship that you had with Shell during the, especially the issue surrounding Nigeria, and because as the litigation has shown, the litigation saga has shown, I think multinationals are often very difficult to hold responsible through the formal laws and human rights, international human rights system in general. So did you feel like in your partnership, were you able to have some sway over the issues that were surrounding that that problem? And in general, do you think that there are coalitions like yours or between businesses as well have any sway and can hold multinationals responsible for humanitarian and human rights violations?
Okay, and there's a chap in the middle here. Yeah, with the scarf, black scarf. Just say who you are. We'll take the fourth one as well. Yeah, hi. Who are you? Hi.
Thank you. I'm Ari. I'm a student here at LSE. So I want to frame my question around the idea that there's a market of private sector engagement. And so my question is from the perspective of NGOs, the UN and humanitarian organizations, what are sort of the organizational features that you try to create to attract private sector engagement and facilitate sort of viable partnerships? And then from the private sector perspective, what are the organizational features of partners that you look for that you think both complement your own expertise and that could enable a successful engagement?
Okay, fine. And gentleman over here.
I'm representing Kyiv Center of Political Studies and Conflictology, Ukrainian think tank. Currently, as a world experience, as a rollback in globalization, and this results in increase of the role of the states. Therefore, it affects both business relations and trade, because it creates politicization of these relations. And may you just provide a reflection on these points? Is this tendency inevitable?
Okay, I think we'll probably come back for some clarification on that question. Yeah, that'll take 2 days to answer, I think. Now we'll have a go on that one. Will Davis's question, coming from a practical point of view now, Chatham House, but in the Army, very interesting perspective. Who would like to have a go on that one? Anybody? Mary, do you want to have a go on that one? Roll the military in this?
I mean, I can answer your specific question on the role of the British Army in sort of conflict sensitivity analysis. I mean, the first thing to say is, in all of the places where I've worked, and the majority of places, the military will often be part of what we call these joint assessments of conflict and stability, which are basically our analysis of the context that the government has. And those are often pretty thorough, and those give the military, if they're operating there, a pretty good sense of what's going on. And off the back of that, build strategies around what role they have in helping build stability in that place. I do think the nature of the military operations and how you function probably means it's very different to NGOs or governments or the private sector, especially how you engage with local communities. But I did, and just because I was in South Sudan, this example comes to my mind. There's a British military contingent there that are part of the peacekeeping mission that run medical facilities. And one thing that I was told is that what they do is they make those facilities, they're meant just for peacekeepers, but the British Army is very good at opening them up to the local community and engaging with the local community and providing those services. And that's something that's was not common to all the peacekeeping operations there. So the British Army sort of, highlighted as doing that and being able to engage with communities in that way is a very positive practice.
But not all armies are going to be perceived in that way.
Yeah.
Once you see a uniform, I think most people.
Yeah.
Mary, do you want to come in on that one as well?
Yeah.
Just keep on that one, then we'll move on to the next.
Yeah. A very good point. Rather like the private sector comes in all different shapes and forms. Course, armies do as well. But yes. I think the army is a very good example of how there are good grounds for including them, although I suppose in a sort of formal sense, being part of partnerships may be more difficult. But I think the reasons are that the army maybe, and if we talk about the British Army or some other intervening armies, I mean, you may have to have them inside the circle because they're essential to stabilise. You can't do much unless there's an absence of violence. So they need to be there. They are there. They're present and they're capable. And I think our experience of working with the military over the years in sort of conflict, post-conflict situations is that they're very good. British Army is a great example of you have fantastic capacities and logistics. Mm. So let's bring them into the picture. However, you know, there is a tendency also that those logistics are so overwhelming that they swamp everybody else's capacities. So I think it's a good example of how, you know, balancing between different kind of resources is needed. I don't, you know, and then it comes back to the question, who should do that? Who restrains, you know, one actor, whether it's the private sector, whether it's the government, whether it's the army, and especially if you're talking about an army which is, you know, often not willing to be restrained. Who does that? So who takes leadership inside these kind of coalitions? And I think the other resource sometimes, but clearly not always, that armies can bring is that they are trusted, because they may be trusted because they're seen as delivering some kind of stability or protection. Double-edged sword, quite literally, obviously.
Can I just add on that? I know we're getting a bit onto the military side of things, but I've got a very particular experience with the British military, of which I'm a huge fan, by the way. But in the sort of post-Afghanistan PRTs, quick impact projects, all of that kind of emerging approach, then there was the move towards the, at first it was a comprehensive approach, and then it was the kind of fusion doctrine. It's sort of gone up a sort of change. And in 2010, the military convened this ex-joint focus exercise where they pulled together like 400 military, the Foreign Office, DFID staff, and me and a girl from MSF, right? We were the NGO civil society representative, and we kind of played out this humanitarian emergency to see what the integrated approach would actually look like. And me and Sandrine were there to sort of explain what the different lanes were and how to stay in the lane. And it was a fascinating exercise, partly because it was just fascinating, but also to see how completely open certainly people engaged in that kind of operation were to a really frank conversation about, this is not your lane, this is why we need you to get out of the way and let the humanitarians who are experts in this do this. This is why quick impact projects are a terrible idea. A completely open and frank conversation. But the opportunity for something like that is so rare, because we don't engage, we don't partner. And frankly, I mean, okay, there was only me and Sandrine. The last time they'd done the exercise, they'd had actors play the civil society. So, you know, it had come a long way. But I think it's really interesting how far that's evolved. Like, even since 2007, I continue to see progression in the right direction. I mean, I think the British military really...
Selina, you've got the next question on Shell and Nigeria.
Shell and Nigeria.
Yeah, there you go.
Do we have any influence over Shell, particularly in relation to that particular case, or their behaviour more broadly? I mean, I'd like to think so, but no. Directly, do we go in there and try to influence on a particular case? No, of course not. We couldn't kind of form a relationship on that basis. Do we go in there quite clearly saying, you know, we both have skin in this game. We can only partner with someone like Shell, you know, when they have a relatively good reputation. That's why we're partnering with them on renewables. That is an area where we have shared interest and can do really good work together. Does that help keep their commitment to renewables? Maybe it's a small contribution. But we have to understand the power dynamics of that relationship. And I think that's where the naivety piece becomes really important. But if we're moving towards a world where corporations are more likely to partner with NGOs, is that generally going to move things in the right direction? I believe so. In the same way that if we partner with the Chinese government, or we partner with other people who we think, you know, there might be a move towards a slightly more enlightened approach.
And we had two other questions. A chap here over there, private sector and inevitability. I'm not quite sure I picked up any of those, but clearly enough, anyway.
Yeah, there was one question which was about how do NGOs attract the private sector, and the one about kind of how the private sector kind of looks at NGOs.
Right.
I don't know that there's a kind of a one size fits all, really. So I think it's a bit, little bit like a marriage, I suppose. So you kind of, you know, so you kind of go out on a date first. You kind of see if you're aligned in small ways. This is why we often do, you know, pilots together. So things like, do we share the same values? Well, on paper we might, but how does that translate into the teams that actually work? What's our culture like? A huge thing that's important to the private sector is what's the energy like of the partner? So what's their pace and their commitment? And this isn't necessarily saying that the private sector moves really fast and governments are slow. Some big private sectors can be really slow, and the NGO might be nimble and so on. So you need to find an organisation where the pace that you can move at is aligned. Otherwise, you end up with kind of frustration on both sides. And so I think that's kind of, it's as simple as that, really. I don't think there's anything more to it. I don't know about from the NGO side when you're looking at the private sector.
It's about finding people where our interests align enough. It doesn't solve, as I say, all the pitfalls, but where, you know, the places we want to work, the kind of things we want to achieve, the way we work, the kind of ethos. Most schools are very committed to working with the private sector and doesn't have any disdain for it. And I think that helps. But I think it is a long process of a lot of first dates. A lot of first dates with corporations, so it does take time.
I think one thing I just come in on that Selena mentioned before, which is about kind of understanding kind of the long-term objectives. You know, it's like, do we both want to have children? You know, that kind of thing. Do you want to progress your career? I want to progress my career. I want to travel abroad. Do you want to? I mean, and particularly actually when it comes to kind of understanding the commercial imperatives of the private sector, to know that actually this is something that's always going to be there. And the private sector understanding actually the kind of real values and the social impact that the NGO or the government or the other organisation is looking to achieve.
Okay, I was getting a bit worried about your marriage. 40% of marriages end in divorce. I think we're going to bring it to an end. I was going to ask you a very embarrassing question, Todd. Will you be back here next year as a member of the Department of International Development or a member of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office? Because there is a rumour out there. There is a rumour out there, but it's only a rumour.
I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Obviously, don't believe it, because we want you to survive and to prosper, because I think you do a damn good job, actually. Anyway, I think we're going to draw it to an end now. We're just coming up to 8 o'clock. Just a few points to make very quickly. One, there are forms there, feedback forms. I wonder if you could just take a minute or so to fill them in. It helps us enormously to improve what we deliver, because one of the many things that we try and do through LSE Ideas is to provide forum for discussion, for debate, not just for students, not just for faculty, but also for that great thing called the British public and any member of the public who lives in this particular great city of ours. It's a public service and we are a public university. So that's great for us to get that kind of feedback. And then thank you again for all the great questions you've asked. I also want to thank the speakers this evening, but I also want to do a bit of private enterprise on behalf of Dr. Mary Martin, because she's not doing it herself. So please get the book. It's a wonderful book. I've even read little bits of it while I've been listening to her this evening. So Mary, congratulations on the book, and I wonder if we can put our hands together and thank the panel. Thank you very much, everybody.